funding for Think comes from SMU Master and Doctor of Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. The discord between Jewish Israelis and their Palestinian neighbors has been so intractable in recent decades that it seems to have existed forever. So a 1913 documentary shot in the region to entice European Jews to support the Zionist movement is in some ways more shocking than the scenes of violence and scorn we have sadly grown accustomed to. In neighborhoods throughout Jerusalem at that time, Jews, Muslims, and Christians mingled and coexisted fairly well. But as European migration continued and smaller percentages of Jewish residents felt connected to Ottoman culture at the very moment the Ottoman Empire was reaching a breaking point, the relative peace between Arabs and Jews in and around Jerusalem became harder to maintain. Filmmaker Ben Loderman explores this complex story in his PBS documentary, 1913, Seeds of Conflict. You can watch it tomorrow night at 8 on KERA Channel 13 television. Ben, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
This film starts with the discovery of another documentary called The Life of the Jews in Palestine. Tell us a little bit about what it depicted, who made it, and why.
Well, I can't tell you exactly what it depicted because during the first year I worked within realm of the film, I was watching a VHS copy, which is just terrible. You could barely see what was going on in the foreground, let alone the background. And what it depicted was a booming, budding land, a happy people. It was a film full of hope and some say insight. Once we were in the editing room ourselves with our film, we were lucky to get a early copy from the Cinematheque in Jerusalem, Israel, of the film which had just been digitally transferred to 4K, a very high-res HD resolution. And suddenly, the foreground pops. You can see everything. But the background becomes very noticeable. And suddenly things that were just a gray din on a VHS copy became a very understandable background. And that background and kind of falling off the edges of the frame was Arab. It showed Arabs of Palestine at that time who were clearly separated from the focus of the photographer and some say the focus of activity in Palestine at that time.
Hmm. Let's talk about the kind of persecution that Jews were dealing with in Europe in the late 19th century that would have truly made Palestine look like the promised land.
Terrible persecution. Persecution that starts after Tsar Alexander II is assassinated. And while not necessarily blamed specifically for killing him, the Jews were largely blamed for the economic turmoil that ensues after the Tsar's assassination. So they are visited upon by rapists, by killers, by rioters in something known as the pogroms. And there would be several waves of these through history. But this was the first major one in Russia, and it showed Jews that they really had no place to escape to. None of Europe was particularly hospitable or welcoming of them, and so this became in the eyes of Jews who lived there who were suffering under this persecution, and even very aristocratic Jews as far away as Vienna, like someone called Theodor Herzl, that there was only one solution for what they increasingly called the Jewish problem. And that was somehow to create a homeland, a home state for the Jews of this part of Europe.
Tell us about the ethnic and cultural breakdown of the population of Ottoman Palestine in the mid-19th century and on into the early 20th century.
So we're leaving Europe now, and we go from a vast expanse of land that ranges from what I think is today's Bulgaria, around through Eastern Europe, down through Constantinople, today's Istanbul, into Asia as far east as today's Iraq, keep going around through Palestine, through today's Egypt, Libya, and almost to Morocco. So it's this huge backward C-shaped swath of land. It's overwhelmingly Muslim in religious makeup. The Ottoman Empire as a state is something of a religious state. Jews and Christians live there relatively peacefully, but in the mid-1800s, out of maybe a quarter million people who lived in Ottoman Palestine, which is what we call it before 1908, 85% or so were Muslim, about 11% were Christian, and about 4% were Jewish. And the Christians and the Jews knew their place, which was as second-class citizens. I mean, it was laid out. It was stated in something called the Millet system, which was a way of counting people and keeping track. And Ottomans, like many good empires, Egyptian and otherwise, were good at keeping track of their people.
And what kind of cultural identity did those Ottoman Jews who had been in the region for centuries, in some cases, what kind of cultural identity did they have? How much did they relate to the Ottoman Empire as the source of sort of understanding who they were?
They had a kind of identity that's hard for us today in 2015 America to understand. They were Jewish Arabs. Or you might say they were Arab Jews. Mm-hmm. But either way, that's not something that rolls off the tongue today. Okay, but from Baghdad to Beirut to Damascus, you had large Jewish populations in what are today wholly Arab and wholly non-Jewish, absent of Jews, places. Things were different then. A guy like Albert Entebbe, who comes to Jerusalem as a young man, comes from Damascus. He comes from a line of three generations of rabbis in Damascus. His first language is Arabic. There's not a whole lot of Hebrew spoken, though he could speak Hebrew. A lot more French was spoken, and he was good at it, which is why he was offered the job of heading the French school in Jerusalem. And he swam like Jewish fishes swam throughout that society and throughout that empire. They had kind of flexible identities. Yes, they were Jews. Yes, they were Arabs. Yes, they were Ottomans, which created this kind of umbrella of an empire for people to get along and have coffee together and mingle. We never found evidence of intermarriage, though we looked. But there was tremendous mingling back and forth in courtyards and apartment houses where people lived together, Jews, Muslims, Christians, coffee houses where those three and others gathered happily and together. Doesn't happen now. It was a time before the old city of Jerusalem was what you would think of it now if you went there on a tourist visit. It was not quartered. It wasn't the Armenian quarter, the Christian quarter, the Jewish quarter, the Muslim quarter of the old city. It was, if anything, quartered by different criteria. The vegetables were in one part of the old city. The meats were in another part of the old city. The spices were in a third part of the old city. So the criteria were completely different.
So, Ben, it's worth noting that of the Jews who left Eastern Europe as the pogroms sort of swept through and began really persecuting people, large numbers of them, the majority of them, went other places besides Palestine. In fact, most of them, I gather, ended up in the United States when these waves of migration began. But what really drew those immigrant Jews specifically to Palestine, those who decided to make homes there, and how did they sort of decide that this could be the place where they could start over in a different way, fundamentally different way than just, you know, moving to New York City and trying to start a business?
Different reasons at different times. In that first wave of immigrants, or the first Aliyah that left Eastern Europe after the Tsar's assassination, people were looking for a better life. They were looking for economic sustenance. And 97% of the people who left, of maybe 20, 25,000 Jews at that time, they left for America. Only 2 or 3% went to Palestine. And they went for the same reasons their forefathers had been trickling in smaller numbers. And that is to say, these were mostly religious, mostly spiritual people, mostly old people who wanted to die and be buried in the Holy Land. That was a dream they kept. And that's why they came. They weren't particularly industrious people. They were people who had a connection to the Holy Land. Now, that changes. By 25 years later, by roughly 1905 or so, there's another wave of pogroms. This is sparked largely by the Russian Revolution. And those who come to Palestine in this second wave, this second Aliyah, they're young people. They're socialists. They're communists. They have a political agenda. They're plugged in a completely different way than those people of the first Aliyah. And they decide they're coming to make their homeland, to make their state, to make their collective living arrangements, which would become the kibbutz within a few years. And they were not particularly attuned to or interested in who was there before them, what was going on before them, or integrating, like the Jew I mentioned, Albert Entebbe, as somebody who's a Sephardic Jew who saw himself as Ottoman. These Jews who came in the second Aliyah, they weren't having any of that. They were there to build their own state and to speak Yiddish and to parade their Zionist flags, and that's what they did.
They were looking for a clean slate.
Totally.
Of course, a clean slate did not exist.
No, it was not what Jews like I, who was brought up on the West Coast in Los Angeles, were taught to believe in Sunday school, in Hebrew school, that this was a land for a people meant for a people without a land. I mean, there's this beautiful imagery and mythology that Jews learn that, you know, these were sand dunes waiting to be watered. These were marshes waiting to be cleared of pestilence and mosquitoes and bad things. And these were Jews looking to come to a clean slate, as you say. Now, the Jews were offered a clean slate, parenthetically. At the Zionist Congress, which Theodore Herzl presides over, Herzl has been running around to European capitals trying to find this homeland, this clean slate place for Jews. And in fact, the British offered it to him. They said, we have this little backyard, you know, the other 40 or so. And that was a clump of land in Uganda. And Theodore Herzl at the first Zionist Congress jumps up and says, I got the answer. We got it. We're being offered Uganda. And the entire Congress, which had used his work called Der Judenstaat, or the Jewish State, as their manifesto, said, are you kidding? We are not going to Uganda. We are going to Palestine.
We're speaking with filmmaker Ben Loderman. His PBS documentary, 1913, Seeds of Conflict, airs tomorrow night at 8 on KERA television. If you'd like to join our conversation or ask a question, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can apply now for fall and design your own master's degree at SMU, a customizable evening master's degree for working professionals. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with filmmaker Ben Loderman about his new documentary, 1913 Seeds of Conflict. You can watch it tomorrow night at 8 o'clock on KERA Channel 13 Television in North Texas. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Okay, Ben, so you have these waves of Jewish immigrants, the second wave that is more political, interested in these really collective farming projects, the kibbutzes, and they have really different ideas about land ownership than the people who had been occupying that land historically for some time, including the Bedouins.
They do, and that's kind of the nub of the whole thing is what I came to learn in putting the film together. There was just a basic cultural disconnect, it seems, between the relationship of people living on the land who were some Bedouins, some farmers, some villagers, the people who used to own the land, which were large, often absentee landowners, mostly Arab, who lived in places as far away as Baghdad or Beirut. Some lived in the metropolis of Jerusalem. And Jews who came in with what would be very familiar ideas of land ownership to you or I. If you or I go to buy a house or a place to live, we have a title search done by the lawyers. We want to know who owned the land, that it's owned free and clear, and that they have the right to sell it. It doesn't exist in Ottoman Palestine. In fact, there was a story on NPR a few weeks ago about how difficult it is for Palestinians today in both the West Bank and in Gaza to sell a home or a place to live from one to another because there's no tradition of this thing we call title deeds. Jews from Russia were very familiar with title deeds. They understood land ownership in a much more Western sense. They were able to get Ottoman officials on the ground through persuasion, through bribes, through whatever, to make, quote, legal their process of buying the land. They waived their title deed in the face of the Bedouins, who didn't own the land. They had always lived there. They had always passed it through generations. It always was a source of self-worth for them. And these Russian Jews, they say, sorry, kids, we own the land now. Here's my title deed. Could you please leave by tomorrow? And there was just a complete misunderstanding of the relationship between the Bedouins and farmers who saw themselves as custodians of this land, who saw themselves as almost religiously connected to the land. And people at screenings of our film before the broadcast have made analogies to Native Americans and how they saw land as opposed to people coming in. And I think they're not completely off base.
Would the idea have been previously that it didn't really matter who owned the title to the land if, you know, Bedouins had been on it and not really causing any trouble, they would just be, the expectation would be that they could remain regardless of who owned the piece of paper that said this land belongs to you?
Yes. I mean, if the Bedouins or the farmers or the villagers who were on that land, who had been there for generations in their family, were willing to pay a pittance to these large landowners who lived elsewhere that went to the taxes that those landowners would owe the empire, it was all good.
And meanwhile, as the Zionist movement is picking up strength and there's more money flowing into the effort to purchase property, to create these kibbutzes, lots of these absentee landowners were happy to make a quick buck off immigrant Jews who said, yes, we'll buy your land and we'll pay you handsomely for it.
They'd never seen anything like it. I mean, they just walked into a pot of money. These distant and absentee landlords sometimes traded land among themselves. Sometimes, you know, a little bit of land is worth more than another piece of land. But here were Jews coming in and saying, we will pay you five times what that land is worth. We will pay you 10 times what this land is worth. And not because they came with pockets full of money from the Pale of Russia. the people who organized this process, who are Zionists from Europe, like Arthur Rupin, who comes from Germany, those people know that it's going to take a lot of money to put this project, this Zionist project that would eventually become the State of Israel, together. And so there are people a generation older than me, and that means people in their maybe 60s at the youngest now, 70s, 80s, 90s for sure, have told me personal stories about their grandparents in Europe, in America, who at every kosher butcher, at every Jewish market, at synagogue for sure, there were what they uniformly call the little blue boxes. And these were charity boxes that were that got filled up with American coins and dollar bills even, and the same in Europe. And this money all got funneled to the World Zionist Organization, which then, you know, allotted it to people like Rupin on the ground in Palestine to buy as large and connected and contiguous plots of land as they could for these very poor peasants from Russia. So we shouldn't think of the Olim, the people coming, the immigrants themselves, as coming with pots of money. But money was raised for them in someone else's name, who was maybe an Ottoman Jew like Albert Entebbe, to buy that land in a means that was kind of legal, and then hand it over to these Jewish settlers to make settlements, because that was the idea, to settle Israel.
And Entebbe saw the writing on the wall and had real concerns about the effect that this might have over time.
For people who were there, for Sephardic Jews, there was both confusion and disconnect with what this thing called Zionism was. And I think it's reasonable to point out that Zionism is many things and different things to different people. As a Jew from Damascus who now headed the French school in Jerusalem, I think Entebbe felt he liked the idea of Jewish cultural empowerment, Jewish financial or economic empowerment, and he was thrilled to work with and be with side by side any, quote, Palestinians or Ottoman Arabs in Palestine who could help that. So in that way, he was maybe something of a Zionist. What he didn't like was a group of clearly outsiders, clearly from a different place, clearly of a different culture, coming in and making a very organized, somewhat secretive land grab. He called himself Ottoman. He didn't call himself a Zionist. And he wondered why, when the Zionists came, they were marching to Russian band sounds and waving Yiddish flags. I mean, he just thought, what the hell is going on?
There was a pattern by which the Zionists were acquiring plots of land that I had been unfamiliar with until I saw the film.
Me too. So what I was on a quest was to learn, okay, Theodor Herzl writes this manifesto. He writes this sort of dreamy idea of a homeland for Jews, a state for Jews, Der Judenstaat, he calls it. And sort of how practically did they make it happen? Well, they made it happen through largely putting a man on the ground. And that's what Arthur Rupin was. He was organized Zionism's man on the ground. He landed in Jaffa. And he quickly kind of rolled out the maps of Palestine, and he figured out, oh, if we buy this plot of land from this absentee landlord and this plot of land right next to it from this other absentee landlord, then the plots can become connected and we can have schools that they share, we can have hospitals that they share, we can start maybe, if nobody's looking too hard, to have post offices they can share. And should the need ever come, they would be easier to guard, by the way. So those began as four little plots or clumps of settlements that kind of look like they organically grow, but in fact they very strategically and tactically grew at the hands of Arthur Rupin. And once they begin to form an N shape, that is from going in the south of today's Israel from Jaffa, Tel Aviv area, up the coast where there aren't hills yet, and then kind of through a certain valley, and then up the Galilee again. There was what became known by historians as the N-shaped pattern of settlement. And fast forward, 50 years to 1948, those settlement patterns, that line, becomes the basis on which the UN map of partition in 1948 is based. So what happened in the years leading up to 1913 and what would ultimately be deemed the State of Israel, they, when you overlay them, the lines are exact.
And I know the Ottoman Empire had a lot going on at this time in history, but it would seem that they would have fought, the Sultan would have fought to exercise more control over the rates of European immigration, seeing what was going on. Why did that not happen?
Well, first, let's give the Sultan credit. He did think to crack down on this, but things had gone too far, too fast. The laws of the land were too loose. Ottoman Palestine, if you look at it on a map, it is a heck of a horse ride from Jerusalem to Istanbul. And there was not a lot of travel going on. The Palestine part of and beyond Palestine of the Ottoman Empire was really considered the real backwater. I mean, I don't know where the most barren place in Texas is, but this is the equivalent.
I could name a few, but continue.
That's what was happening when the Sultan, who is, also having trouble with all these ethnic groups. I think if you were the Sultan, it was hard to keep track of who was who. Is this a problem with the Greeks again? Hmm. Oh, no, wait. The Armenians are causing trouble. Who are those people up in the Slovak-speaking places? Oh, my God, the Moroccans are falling away now. Russia's were starting to battle Russian empire to empire. There were many bigger things going on in the minds of the upper reaches of the Ottoman Empire than this thing. Now, you're right. The last thing they needed with all this other stuff going on was some other ethnic group coming together, congregating, causing a fight and wanting freedom in a homeland. I mean, who needs that headache? So it was illegal for Jews to come to the empire and just settle in Palestine. They were meant to disperse themselves throughout the empire because Arab leaders, Ottoman leaders like Ruhi Halady, who was Jerusalem's representative in parliament, said outright, these people know a lot. They know a lot about finance. They know a lot about education. They're well educated. And we can learn a lot from these people. They just have to not congregate any one place and take over. They have to go settle throughout the empire, disperse themselves, and integrate. And that's not what that second Aliyah, that second wave of political young Jews who were experiencing in their own lives, elements of the Russian Revolution, that's not what they had in mind.
For a while, as they were starting up farms and settlements, there were economic opportunities for neighboring residents, regardless of ethnicity. And then those opportunities began to dry up as the feeling spread that these sort of Zionist projects should be completely staffed by Zionists, by Jews.
Right. So rather than going to America, those that came in the second wave of immigration to Palestine began to look around. And if they weren't going to New York, where the streets are supposed to be paved with gold, and they're stepping on straw, they have a real problem if they're going to try to build a vibrant society. So Jews from that first wave before them had come, and because they were spiritual in nature, they were religious in their reasons for coming, they were not great farmers, they were happy to employ local Arabs to do that farming for them on land that was purchased in their name. Not so the second wave. The second wave said, no, we're all about this. We are going to remake ourselves, and we are going to remake ourselves as what became known as the New Jew. And the New Jew was not this little shriveling old guy, old white guy with a beard, hunched over some Jewish text. This was a brawny Russian big guy and, well-tanned and muscular and very much tied spiritually in every other way to the land. So they wanted to do the farming themselves. The other thing that came into play was the labor market. I mean, the Arabs who had farmed this land, they were either Bedouins or farmers who stayed in one place but lived the lifestyle of Bedouins, which is to say incredible poverty. And they were not making very much money even by the first wave of immigrants to do the farming. The second wave realized that if we're going to pay these people a pittance, then anybody who farms is going to get a pittance. And the only way we create a market for farming where the labor is getting a living wage. I mean, we're not talking about, $6-7 an hour here. We're talking about the equivalent of $15 an hour. If we're going to create that for these new Jewish immigrants, well, there's only one thing we can do. We can boycott and exclude Arabs as labor. So if you only have to hire Jews, you then get to set the floor of what the pay is. And that's what happened.
Filmmaker Ben Loderman is here. We're talking about his new documentary, 1913, Seeds of Conflict. You can see the whole thing tomorrow night at 8 on KERA Channel 13 television. If you'd like to join the conversation, we have lines open at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can apply now for fall and design your own master's degree at SMU, specializing in communications or organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is documentary filmmaker Ben Loderman. His movie 1913 Seeds of Conflict airs tomorrow night at 8 on KERA Channel 13 television. You can join us by emailing think@kera.org or you can call 1-800-933-5372. Okay, Ben, let's talk about the Young Turk Revolution. There was this idea that autonomy for individual ethnic groups, I gather including Jews, was a good thing. But this was not easy in the execution.
Yeah, I mean, there are two things to think about. One is that this is part of a movement that's going global. And it's going beyond the Ottoman Empire, and it's basically at the turn of the century something called nationalism. That is the formation of nation states, often at the expense or carved out of empires that were existing. So this was kind of a new wave sweeping the globe. And as you said, the Ottoman Empire had a lot on its plate. There were a lot of issues within the empire, so that what the Sultan decided was that things are getting a little bit out of control and we need to ratchet down on people. And there were a core of opponents to that idea right under his nose in Istanbul. And what happened was that intellectuals, just as intellectuals and army people were coming together in Russia and other places to form revolutions, that's what happened in the Ottoman Empire. And in 1908, the Young Turk Revolution consisted largely of very high-up army officers, very well-known and established intellectuals, and they overthrew the Sultan. And what did they replace the Sultan with? Well, I'm not sure they knew either. So they kind of looked around and said, hey, this thing the French have going, I mean, this is really working. This is, you know, fraternité, égalité, you know, a kind of new sense of buy-in they wanted from people who they were now willing to extend a much greater sense of citizenship and autonomy to. So at the very beginning of 1909, right after the revolution, there is a kind of euphoria within the empire. A lot of new freedoms are opening up. There is a sense of fraternité and egalitarianism. And, you know, little by little, because news doesn't travel so fast in that time, news makes its way down to Ottoman Palestine. And I think that sense of hope, of sincere coming together as new citizens, took hold. It just took hold differently for different people. Ottoman Arabs in Palestine and especially in Jerusalem thought one thing, and they thought this was perhaps the way to get the yoke of the Sultan and the empire and all of its rules and regulations off their back. And Jews saw it another way. They said, hey, we've been talking homeland. We've been talking statehood. Here's our shot. So the friction and the ability for there to be friction, for there to be a tremendous amount of new newspapers opened up, both Arabic newspapers and Hebrew newspapers, kind of bloomed forth as part of these new freedoms. The point is, once they had not an empire or a sultan to kind of grieve against, they began having grievances against each other.
So Jewish immigrants really sort of doubled down on guarding and protecting their own property, this, you know, what turned out to already be disputed territory. They wanted to make sure that it was held only by the people who had legal title to it.
Right. And what we're seeing at this point after the Young Turk Revolution are the seeds of demise of the Ottoman Empire. I mean, things are kind of spinning out of control. The Sultan has lost control. There are new ideals being brought forth, but it all depends on people buying in and paying their taxes and supporting financially the empire, which for the empire was done mostly or most energetically or enthusiastically by the Jews. The Jews did pay their taxes. And for many at this point in the empire, that's enough. Arabs felt differently, they thought differently, and because of that lack of control, that disintegration of control within the empire, if you had things of value, which was increasingly land, you had better guard on your own because the Ottomans were not going to police society on the ground like they had once done. So, you know, like echoing things that had happened before it, at first, the first Aliyah owners of land, they employed guards. Everybody employed guards suddenly. And they employed Arab guards. So there was nothing about guarding particularly that signaled strife between Arabs of Palestine. And it's funny, I always want to call them Palestinians, but then I have to catch myself because we don't have Palestinians or Israelis yet.
Right.
So everything, you know, jumps forward in your mind to today's mindset. But things, you know, things of value had to be guarded also by Arabs of Palestine, but Jews of Palestine employed Arabs, again, as fairly cheap labor to guard their vineyards, to guard their settlements, to guard their by now kibbutzim, the plural of kibbutzes. That's what they did. The members of the second Aliyah looked at this and said, you know, we told you with the farming business, this isn't how it works. We are forming a Jewish state. We are protecting ourselves. We are integrating synagogue and state at that point. And there will be no more Arab guards. There will be Jewish guards. So whereas one of our interviews in the film says, before, if you hired some Arab guards, you even got a little bit of a protection system going. You know, it's like, pay me as a guard and I won't come in and rob your land. That changed.
And correct me if I'm overstating this, but it sounds like some of these Jewish guards almost seem to have taken cues from like the Cossacks who had persecuted them back in the old country.
It's what we say. It's what we imply in the film. We don't say explicitly, but these thugs, which is what they were, these gangs, okay, these people who offered mafia style protexia to the settlements, had learned well. You know, I mean, say what you will about it, but these were people who had been victims and knew the hand of force and hate, and that's kind of what they knew, so that's what they used.
And then things came to a head violently over what sounds today like a heartbreakingly minor infraction.
Yeah, but you have to measure heartbreak. I mean, if you're willing to go with me and say that the killing of two people then is probably significant like the way of killing 10 people is now.
Let me stop you, because I did not mean to imply that the killing of two people was the minor infraction. There was a minor theft. Am I correct about that?
Yeah, okay. Absolutely. Right. There was a minor theft, and I was hearing your question in a different way. Forgive me. I mean, last summer there was a minor infraction of sorts. Three Jewish boys were kidnapped and killed. Then there was a revenge killing. Jews killed an Arab for no good reason, and I believe set him on fire, okay? Yeah. And, you know, pretty soon, 2 + 3 + 1 equals the Gaza war today. So what is reminiscent for today is how quickly that dry tinder can erupt into flames.
What this wasn't about initially was different ideas about the nature of God and the universe, which is something that I think today everyone understands that it's a land dispute and a political dispute. But there's also this sense that all sides have God on their side.
You know, it was a much more accepting time. It was a much more heterogeneous time. You know, when Jews and Christians and Arabs all sat very comfortably and talked together and held court together, which is basically what coffee houses did at that time. It provided the function that today for many of us newspapers provide, which is just a kind of general and shared discourse of what's going on in our world. It was a much more forgiving time. It was a time when, as a Jew, I know my grandmother used the term Shabbos Goy. That was a Christian person who would come in and turn on or off the lights for you or take out the garbage on the Jewish Sabbath. Well, in Ottoman Palestine, Jews did that for Christians. Christians did that for Jews. They both did it for Muslims during Ramadan and cooked the food and all that. So it was a more caring. It was a more, you know, I'm rubbing my fingers together to say kind of genuine and personal, personable society.
How close did Jews and Arabs come after the conflict, that initial conflict, to working out some solution? This was 1913.
This close. Yeah. And now I'm squeezing my fingers together because it was after this incident in Rehovot where a Jew and an Arab are killed that the Arabs of Palestine decide to have their own Congress. Now, one has to be sensitive. I'm Jewish, and I am corrected often by Palestinian scholars that not everything that happened in Palestine were Arabs reacting to Jews. There were other forces at play, and I'm sure there were here too. But it was just after this incident that the Arabs of Palestine decided to have their own Congress, just as the Zionists had had their Congress several years before. And they gathered in Paris, and what was different about it was they invited Zionists and Jews to come be participants, not to be voting members, but to be observers, to hold talks, and in this case, to secretly begin to negotiate a peace between Arabs and Jews in Palestine. If this is sounding familiar, it's happened again and again and again at precious moments in history. The Oslo Accords being the one that is most recently referred to. And they did, but as they were working this out, they saw which way the war was going, the war being World War I, which had by now started. And Palestine Arabs, by and large, threw their lot in with the Ottomans and the allies of the Ottomans, that is to say the Germans and other powers that were aligned with them. And at the time, they thought other rising Arab powers. The Jews, I think, began to see that the British were definitely going to win, and there was no sense in making a local peace to be caught up in larger world issues that were not going to look good for them. And so they kind of secretly bet on the British to win. And at some point, the Zionists called their representative who was attending this conference at Paris and said, leave. So, and he said, I can't leave. What am I going to say? They said, don't say anything. Leave. And one can't accuse the Jews of being wrong because it was at the end of World War I. That is the first name that I associated with as that West Coast Jew of being related to the origins of Israel or a state or a homeland for the Jewish people came forth. And that was Lord Balfour. Right. And this is a British lord who writes on a scrap of paper, the Jews deserve a homeland. Not much more than that, but that was enough to get them going.
We only have about 30 seconds left, and I regret that. But what should we make of this story that we can't change today, but it does seem like it's important to understand?
Well, look, I turn to my historical gurus, which I call my rabbis on such matters, and they include David McCullough, perhaps the greatest American living historian who I've worked with personally. So I take him to heart very much as a person as well as a figure or book writer. And he says a couple things. He says, history is a friend in perilous times. We can learn how to act now from learning history. And I think we do that. And there are others who say that to act now, we have to know who we are. And to know who we are, we have to know who we were. So that's why someone like me goes through this exercise.
Filmmaker Ben Loderman directed the documentary 1913, Seeds of Conflict. You can see it tomorrow night at 8 on KERA Channel 13 television. Ben, thank you so much for making this time for us.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. The show's email address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.